In February 2008, journalist Jerry Van Dyke, who had spent a lot of years in Afghanistan, was kidnapped by the Taliban, and he was held for 45 days. At that point, he was the second American journalist to be kidnapped. The first, of course, was Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded by his captors 6 years before Jerry was taken. Jerry wrote about that whole experience in 2010 in a book called Captive, which I talked to him about at the time. And now he's got a new book about going back to Afghanistan to investigate and report on his own story. The book is called The Trade, My Journey into the Labyrinth of Political Kidnapping. Jerry Van Dyke, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to be back.
Nice to have you here. By the way, that's a word, a phrase I'm sure you've said a lot. It's good to be back. 100%. The Taliban, when they captured you, they told you that they were going to exchange you for three of their own who were imprisoned at Gitmo. And if that didn't work, they would hold you for a ransom of $1.5 million. But no prisoners were exchanged for you, and the U.S. has a policy of not paying ransom. So why were you released?
That was why I went back. Because when I got out, came to JFK and the FBI and Homeland Security, and a group of people met me and took me through customs. We were sat down in a room inside the airport in New York, and they said, "Welcome home. Welcome home. You're safe. You're safe." I said, "Thank you. I'm fine. It's good to be back." And then they said, "There are three messages for you by the Taliban on your answering machine." That's when we had those things.
Yeah.
Could you tell us what they were? And who they are and so forth. And then I said, I'd like to know, because I don't really know what has happened inside and how I got out. But there was a drone overhead for a month. Was that drone there because the Taliban were coming and going? Was it to watch for them, or was it for me? And the lead FBI agent on my case said, "We brought all assets into play." In other words, "I'm not going to tell you, Jerry."
Mm.
And that's what happened. And I would hear things, snippets over the years, that this happened, that happened, and no one would tell me anything. No one from the government, no one from CBS, where I had this, I was a consultant on Afghanistan, Pakistan, Al-Qaeda. And I became ever more frustrated. And then the CBS bureau chief in London called me and said, "The FBI did not do anything. Michael Semple released you, got you out. Michael Semple, he worked for the UN. He's said to be a member, part of British intelligence. And the British, of course, have had 350 years in Afghanistan. He knows both languages, very well-known man. I would have gone to the farthest corners of the earth to find him." I met him in Washington. He came over. He's Irish, Muslim, married to a Pakistani. We met in Washington, and he said, "We did everything possible to prevent a second Daniel Pearl." And that's all he would tell me. And so that's how it began, that I was haunted. I didn't know. I could not answer your question. How did I get out? Why did I survive and not Daniel Pearl? What was the difference between him and me? Why did, and the FBI, I met with the FBI in New York. They came up to the federal building. And this was the lead FBI agent in Washington. Okay, he came to my apartment and he asked for my notebook, and I gave him my notebook, and he wanted to know the names of the three men in Guantanamo that they wanted. He didn't know those names, and so I gave them to him, and I said, "I wonder what's going to happen now. Who are these men? Were they part of the release of the Bo Bergdahl case?" I didn't know anything, and I was haunted by it.
When I talked to you, Jerry, after you published Captive 7 years ago,
yeah,
I went back to that interview today, and you said that you were haunted by having to provide your captors with your home phone number. You just mentioned that they had left messages on your answering machine at home. They also had the numbers of your family members, and you were worried about that, really, really worried. So I got to ask you, now that you've gone back and you've lived a few more years and have hindsight on this, did anything come of that, and are you still worried about your family?
The hard thing really, what really got me was that the fixer, my guide, the man, the lead man who betrayed me, who, by the way, the FBI came to me. We had dinner in New York. One of the lead guys in my case, the man I like still very much, haven't seen him in a few years, and a forensics expert working on my case, and said, we'd like you to go with us back to Afghanistan, and they wanted specifically to find this man. And I said, I can't do that. I am not going to go back there, and I'm not going to get involved in what's going to happen. That's your job. You have to do that. So, but what really got me was that this man, I gave him my phone numbers because the Taliban wanted to take him to Kabul from wherever I was, bring in his father as a collateral, and have him negotiate my release. Therefore, I gave him, I said, how am I going to get $1.5 million? My family doesn't have this kind of money. My brother and sister are going to have to mortgage their homes. Their children's education is going to take from that. How am I going to do this? So I tried to think of everybody I knew who had a little bit of money, but I also gave him my brother's name and my sister's phone number. You're absolutely right. And that's how he got it. And he started to harass them. And my sister-in-law, as a mother of three children, was worried about her own children. Mm-hmm. So it got to my family. And what could I do? I was sitting here in the U.S. I can't do anything. And he called me. He's called me. He stopped now. But he did find me on Facebook about 100 times. So I you want to do something, but you're trapped. You can't do anything. I want to find out. I wanted to find him. Part of me wished I had gone with the FBI.
Did somebody pay that $1.5 million for you?
I wish I knew. Number one, I think the best way, no one has, to this day, no one has told me. And I found out a great deal when I went back and talked to a lot of people, but no one there. It's hard for me to know who really was straight with me. I went to Afghanistan and Pakistan, talked to everybody involved. One in particular, there's a man named Masrullah Amrullah, A-M-R-U-L-L-A-H, Saleh, S-A-L-E-H. Actually, 60 Minutes portrayed him once, did a story on him. He was head of Afghan intelligence, called NDS. It would be a combination of their FBI, CIA. And I think that we have put that intelligence agency back together and have made it what it is today. And he's not in power anymore. And I went to see him about my case. And this is an Afghan, and I told him, and this is an Afghan I'm talking to an American. And he said, his first question to me after I talked to him was, he said, have you seen the movie 12 Years a Slave? And I said, no, I haven't. At all. He said, well, go see this movie because you're that man. Everybody who you think is your friend is your enemy. And so that, and this is an American ally. So things like that made it extremely difficult. What I tell people who ask me about the book now is when you get 3/4 of the way through it or toward the end, send me an email and let me know who you think did it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's, yes, I do believe, I'm not positive, I do believe some money changed hands. Where it came from, who it went to, who ultimately got it, I don't know. Was it the amount that you asked? I don't, hard for me to say. Hard for me to say. What I do know is that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What I do know and what I found in the, and I had permission from, for example, the New York Times and others to write this in the book, that sometimes government officials say one thing in public and say another thing in private.
Really? Wait a minute. Who did you have to get permission from to say that, Jerry?
Thanks for making me laugh. And so there are cases when this is done. And how it is done, I don't know. By that I mean, I do know that, and this is public, and I do write this in the book, and this is, it's absolutely public. In 2000, two Christian missionaries, Gracie and Martin Burnham, from Kansas, were kidnapped by a group called Abu Sayyaf, ABU and then SAYYAF. And he is still a member of parliament. I think a horrible man. And it's a Muslim separatist group in the southern Philippines, a terrorist organization. And they kidnapped these two missionaries. And they were held in the jungle for almost a year. In the end, the George W. Bush administration paid a ransom. I think it was about $320,000. And what this administration said was that if it leads to the capture, apprehension of the kidnappers, the money disappeared. And then, you may recall, some of your listeners may recall, and this is all on, you can go on YouTube and it's all on television, it's on every network ran the story. There was a highly decorated Special Forces soldier, very close to President Karzai, named Jason Emmerine. And he was tasked by, and I learned this 2015, he was tasked by the Pentagon to do, General Campbell, I think the man's name is, to do all that it took, anything that it took to get Bo Bergdahl out. Mm-hmm. And also, he learned during that time about hostages being held by the Connie Network. One group of whom would be the family, the Canadian American family that somehow either the U.S. with CIA and the Pakistani army got them out, or it's not clear exactly what happened. Yep. Just in the last couple of weeks, that we all know. And he testified both before Congress that in the course of trying to do his work, that he ended up paying a proof of life ransom, and as a result of that, ultimately, he was cashiered out of the Army. He was given different medals, but he was let go within the last couple of years. And I met with him in Washington during the course of my research and with other hostages and the families of those still being held. So, I mean, it is done under the table in certain ways. Did the U.S. government take a role in my case? 100%. Where did the money come from? I don't know. Was there money paid? I honestly don't know. But I'm pretty sure.
But I'm getting the sense that kidnapping is a business.
It has become a business. Since 9/11, that's exactly it. And my research and the way I feel now is that we all know, you and I and most people in the country know that Al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11, but mm-hmm. at the time, at the very beginning, we weren't sure what was going on.
Right.
And I think that this was Al-Qaeda was responsible for the death of Daniel Pearl. That's Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he's in Guantanamo today, has acknowledged or proudly proclaimed that he slaughtered him. That was their way of announcing to the world that they exist. After the next major American kidnapping was Nicholas Berg in Baghdad in 2004, which was a guy named Zarqawi, who was in charge of it, who was trying to create Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He did. It was Al-Qaeda's way of announcing its presence in Iraq. After that, there were two more kidnappings in Afghanistan, and then I was the next person because I was kidnapped in Pakistan.
Right.
And then it began to go from there. Today, Al-Qaeda has a protocol from across Africa on how to deal with kidnappings. And they have I was told in 2013 they have $35 million. So it's now to the point where it is 100% a business that exists in lawless areas where the state doesn't really have control. It has become a highly successful form of political and actual warfare, the weak against the strong.
Yeah.
Look, you know, you can argue that the murder of Jim Foley and then Stephen Sotloff and then Peter Kosick and then the death of Caleb Mueller led to the U.S. going after ISIS.
Wow. Wow. You mentioned earlier that the reason that you got kidnapped in February of 2008 is because your fixer betrayed you there. And then after your 45 days in captivity, however it happened, you came back to the United States, and now here, this book is about going back several years later to investigate and find out. But after your first experience there, when you went back, Jerry, How did you trust anyone?
I didn't. I was so afraid. What I was afraid of was that because the kidnapper, my main jailer said, we let the bird out of the cage the first time. We won't let him out the second time. And I was afraid that as soon as I got to Afghanistan and walked through the airport and gave my passport, that my name would come up in this underground network. The Taliban aren't just bearded men in the mountains with black turbans. It's a very sophisticated operation. And I was absolutely afraid. I was afraid from the time I got off the plane till I got to the hotel. And the hotel is already, there's only one hotel in Afghanistan that is reasonably secure. The Taliban had hit it twice. But now, when I was there, there were more guards and more men with rifles in the hotel than there were guests. And it's the Serena, and it's an expensive hotel, but it's the only safe one. And the first man I went to see was a man I was told by one of the men who betrayed me, not just my fixer, but one of my bodyguards also betrayed me. And he told me that his clan was at war with this man I knew, who was my oldest friend in Afghanistan, who is today the chief negotiator for the Afghanistan, very close American ally, with the Taliban. There's been one peace talks in Pakistan in 2014, and he was the main person. And I sat with him in the room, and I told him in the hotel room that first night, and I told him the whole story. And he said to me, no, that's not how it happened. And he began to about my kidnapping. He said, no, because I was told that I got caught in a crossfire between his family and this other family. And I even got a letter out of the blue. I got a letter from an Al-Qaeda person. I have no idea where he is in the U.S. He's in prison somewhere, who had read Captive, seen me on television, heard me on the radio, maybe on your program. And he wrote me a letter, made a letter to me through the publisher, that I spent a lot of time in this area in the 90s, therefore I know these things, you got caught. And he said the same thing. And so I went and I talked at length with this man, and I talk about this in the book, and he told me, no, that's not how it happened at all, and he told me the whole story. And that is why, after him, I went to see, in his view, what happened. And then that's why, after him, I went to see the former head of the NDS. Both of these men, when they were finished talking to me, said, you must leave the country immediately. It is too dangerous for you to be here.
Wow.
You are part of a large conspiracy. If they find out that you're here, they're going to send someone after you.
Oh, my God. Please tell me you went directly to the airport from that restaurant.
I wasn't in a restaurant. I did not leave the hotel. That was in the hotel. That was in my hotel room.
Call me an Uber. I'm out of here.
There's no Uber.
But you got out, right, please?
Yeah, I left very shortly thereafter. I certainly did.
Wow.
I certainly did. And I felt better once we cleared Afghan airspace.
Jerry, you're a great storyteller, which makes you a great reporter, but you scare the hell out of me. I got to be honest. The book is called The Trade, My Journey into the Labyrinth of Political Kidnapping. Jerry Van Dyke, a veteran journalist who had the cojones to go back to the country where he had been kidnapped and held by the Taliban for 45 days. It's a remarkable story yet again, and I thank you for sharing some of it here with me today.
Thanks so much.
I'm Paul Harris.
Good to talk to you again.
Likewise. This is the Big 550 KTRS.